You're listening to Face Off, episode 77, recorded July 12th, 2010. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jay Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
In this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right. Actually, Mark, coming in via Skype this week.
I got my Icicle, which allows me to hook up my nice mic to the USB. So
you still sound terrible. Mic. I don't think it's your microphone. I think it's your voice. You just have a terrible voice.
I do have some internet issues right now that I'm trying to get resolved with Quest, but it drops every once in a while, so we might have to.
There might be some funky edit noises in the episode, just so everybody knows. You know, I've been having some weird internet. I hate moving. So, you know, my old place, I just knew what to expect, and, you know, I mean, it was pretty good performance, and then it's like you move and there's always this new variable of like, is it, you know, am I crazy or is it my internet bad or, you know, or like, you know, you start goofing around maybe with like, is my router bad? Maybe it's not the internet. I don't know. It's just, you know.
Yeah. There's just so many things that can go wrong with networking type, you know, equipment.
It's amazing. It's one of the things I really don't have like a full grasp on is like how networking works in general. I think it's much more awesome than most people give it credit.
Definitely.
Because I know I don't give enough credit and it's pretty amazing. Let's talk about other amazing things such as our geek tool of the week. So we talk about this. I always love to have clocks. I like to know what time it is. I usually wear a watch. And like, you know, in my car, the clock on the dash is broke. It doesn't work. And that drives me insane. I like clocks. And I like them to be accurate. So, you can get these atomic clocks now. They pull their time off of like the sort of atomic clock signal that's being broadcast everywhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know the specifics, but they've always been what I've seen is digital clocks, you know, and I do like analog clocks. I think analog clocks are really cool. I like them around my house, you know. So that's why I was really excited when I found this. And these have probably been around for a while. I just now found them and am totally jazzed about it. But this our Geek Tool of the Week is the LaCrosse Technology WT3126B radio-controlled aluminum analog wall clock. So it is a wall clock powered by, you know, a AA battery, I think, that gets its time from the atomic time clock and will, like, you know, change its time to be accurate. I think that's crazy.
So this is an analog clock that just, you know, hangs on your wall and you never have to set it and it never speeds up.
You just set which time zone you're in. I think they have four time zones. So actually, the atomic time clock, I believe, you know, what do you call it? Adjusts for daylight savings time. So mm-hmm. You never would have to set it for daylight savings time. I wonder what it looks like when it changes. Like, I wonder if it has to like go all the way around, like when, you know, you fall backwards, if it's like.
Well, you know, I remember seeing these, at our high school that we went to, and I remember watching them. Like, it took I don't know if it took a day or an hour. It's been a while, but I do remember them actually like moving.
Dude, I don't think like they had those in high school. I think you're crazy.
They tried them. They had them in a certain spot.
Where?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure though.
I don't think that atomic time signal was prevalent back then. It must have cost a fortune then.
Well, I don't know.
Because we're old. I don't know if you know, but anyway, so we have two links. The first link is to this particular model, but they have a ton of them. So the second link goes to a list of like all of them. There's a ton of different these clocks, so you can get kind of whatever style you want. I kind of like just the plain classic aluminum one, but there's lots of cool ones, wood frame, even some digital ones. So check it out. Really cool.
Yeah, I mean, they're not too expensive either. Like some of these are, 20 bucks.
Yeah. The cool ones are like 30. But you know what? Think about it. You have a wall clock. You never have to change it when daylight savings time happens. Always accurate. How awesome is that?
Pretty cool.
All right. So check it out. Let's get into our web apps this week. The first web app I have isn't really a web app. I guess I kind of screwed up on this one. But that's okay. It's still really cool, so I want to talk about it. It is called Boomerang. And it is a JavaScript script. Say that five times fast. that is made by Yahoo. And what it does is it's a script that you put inside your page, and you give it sort of a callback place. So you set up, you know, your own application or something to handle the callback. And it sends back all this information about load time and like really cool stuff, like even usable load time. Like sometimes load time isn't just right. You know, it's like, when is the page actually usable? You can sort of get metrics on if you have like images and stuff loading in the background with JavaScript, you can sort of get metrics as to how fast those are loading. And it's just basically, it's a great way to get even more performance data from your actual users.
Wow. So it actually measures the user's bandwidth along with the page load time. So if they're like, if you tend to have like a lot of users with slower internet, you can kind of see that and maybe adjust your images and things.
Yeah, the one I thought was really cool was it can help you measure HTTP latency, which can have a big effect on how your page reacts. You know, sometimes we always think of bandwidth, but if you have high bandwidth but also high latency, you know, sometimes, like, you know, the project we're working on has some AJAX calls where HTTP latency, if it gets too much, I mean, it has sort of a noticeable effect on the user interface.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so check it out. I mean, there's no way we can talk about all of it here in one episode, but it's a really cool thing from Yahoo, and it's called Boomerang, and you can get it at yahoo.github.com/boomerang/doc.
Actually, before we wrap this one up, so, I mean, you just put this JavaScript in there, and you have access to all this information?
No, I mean, you have to set up, if you read the docs, it'll kind of tell you about how to, you have to set up a place to like parse the information. I didn't really read it through when I put it in the show notes, because I thought it was a web app. So I thought that it was like a, it called back to like a Yahoo app that would tell you about, you know, this is the stats of your website, but it doesn't. You have to set up where it calls back to yourself. So like with Rails, this is really easy, because in Boomerang, you just, you know, you, it just sends back, you create a beacon URL, which is like, you know, myapp.com/beacon or whatever. You know, you could do that in Rails or PHP really easily. And then inside that URL, you handle sort of like parsing the parameters of the URL string and doing whatever you want with them, putting them in a database or putting them in a flat file, whatever you want to do. But you do have to set that up yourself.
I kind of like that. I mean, the ability to customize it and do kind of what you want with the data.
Yeah, it is kind of nice that it's it isn't a web app almost, you know, because you have to take care of it. You'll understand what is happening a little bit better, and you know, you're not keeping your data on someone else's service like Google or Yahoo, which has pros and cons. But yeah, so you do have to set that up. But other than that, I mean, it's, once you start getting, you know, if you start getting a lot of users, it's something to put in, and you know, they have some really good examples on how to use it and some good use cases as to, you know, when you want to use it and why. And it's a pretty cool little JavaScript.
Cool. I'm gonna have to look like into this more and maybe try it out.
Yeah, check it out. It's called Boomerang from Yahoo. Our next web app is we've been talking about this one because it's kind of interesting. I've been doing system administration at work lately, and the one thing that I hate is email server administration. So, I mean, any project that I've always done, I've always used Google Apps because they know what they're doing, and I don't. So if I was to run my own mail server, who knows what would happen? It probably wouldn't work half the time. People would be sending spam from it or something. It's a hard thing to do. And so when, you know, Ian, just managing your own email server is hard enough, but then getting an email server that is prepared to send out mass mailings is really hard, because you can really get into trouble of, you know, your server looking like a spam server, or making sure you're formatting stuff right. You know, there's a reason we use services like MailChimp, right? I mean, you use MailChimp, correct?
Yeah, I do. Actually, the first time I kind of ran into this problem is Gmail has a limit, and I believe it's 100 emails an hour, or maybe 300.
Something.
So yeah, we were doing a mailing list. We had permission, you know, from our users to be on this list, and they were subscribed, and we wanted to send them some information, but we kind of had to scale it back because of the spam issues, the blocks in Gmail. So, you know, things like MailChimp is great because it handles all that and is either whitelisted or whatnot and gets to the inbox.
Right. So, the way this Postmark app, which did we actually say it's called Postmark? You can get to postmarkapp.com. What this does is it is a service designed to help you send emails from your application. So if you go to the sort of why use Postmark, the thing it says is the reason you should use Postmark is because right now you're blind. And it's true, you know, you have an app, you set up a local SMT server and SMTP server, start firing emails at it. You don't know if they're bouncing, making it to the inbox, or just failing altogether. But they say, don't worry, it's not your fault. You shouldn't have to worry about this stuff. So what happened is, this is another one of those things we talked about, kind of like Amazon S3. These guys have two apps that people are using, and they found that sending emails from their applications was not difficult. You know, it was kind of difficult, and you never really knew what happened. So what they kind of did was build this email sending infrastructure for their applications. And after a while, they thought, you know, I bet other people could use this. And so they set it up as an application that you can pay for and use. Lots of people are using it. And what it does is just... it's just a good infrastructure for sending emails, because we talk about this a lot. People have their specialties, and as a programmer, your specialty is probably not running an SMTP server,
right?
So
yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm in favor of anything, you know, like outsourcing things that somebody else can do better, and it's oftentimes it's cheaper too. I mean, than hiring programmers or sysadmins to go make sure the email server is working right and all this.
So, I mean, they have all kinds of tools. You can get a Rails gem. You can do, you know, straight Ruby if you're not using, you know, Rails. But you can get PHP code, Python, .NET, ColdFusion. You know, and then also if you want, they tell you how to just access the API straight up. You get 1,000 emails for free. You can pay, what is the pricing? It's pretty cheap. But again, that's the whole point, is just it's nice that we don't have to think about it a lot.
Is it 1,000 for free, forever, or like per month, or?
I think it's 1,000. I think it's 1,000. It's a limit. It's not per month.
I see.
So I think and apparently it's $1.50 for 1,000 emails. So you kind of buy them in 1,000 email chunks.
That's not bad.
Yeah. And nice. It's something to think about. A lot of people, I don't think, you know, most people might not want to do this, but I think it's a really good idea, because oftentimes, you know, if you don't set up your server correctly, you know, someone could be sending spam from your servers, or oftentimes it doesn't work. Like I always find it frustrating, because once it works on a server, it's great. You know, you can just send emails really easy. You don't even have to think about it. But whenever you start up a new server or something, I always have this hard time of trying to figure out how to get my emails to send to it. And then finally when they do, I'm like, oh, thank goodness. But I don't know. Maybe my SMTP server is sitting there wide open for anyone to use. I mean, I don't know. I don't configure them enough to really know.
Well, and even if you do, you don't know if your emails are making it, or if they're getting, you know, spammed or whatnot.
Right. I mean, this has infrastructure behind it. It tells you kind of what's happening with your emails, who's actually looking at them, you know, how many of them are bouncing, which is pretty nice.
Yep.
So check it out, postmarkapp.com. Hey, if you guys have some news to follow up, or web application, or topic that you want us to talk about, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Let us know. We'd love to talk about what you guys like to hear about. Any ideas from you are always appreciated. So go to faceoffshow.com and give us some suggestions.
All right. This week's topic is documentation.
Oh, no. I hate documentation.
Yeah, I love it when it's good and like easy to read and fun, and I feel like I'm learning something, but I hate it when it's not there, and I hate writing it sometimes.
That's sort of the paradox of documentation, is programmers love good documentation, but we hate writing it, and we hate it when it's bad or not there.
So we're going to dedicate this topic to, hopefully shed some light on the various types of documentation and, you know, how and what to write in them.
All right.
So what to write? Tech docs, you know, they range from high-level overviews to step-by-step walkthroughs. And I've even seen auto-generated docs, which are kind of the very technical docs that are kind of just – it basically goes through the code and looks at what parameters are able to be set and things like that.
Right.
You know, people learn differently. So it's, if you're trying to think, you know, which one should I choose? The more, the better.
Right.
As far as, you know, the high level overview versus the step-by-step walkthrough versus auto-generated, users might be at different skill levels. So you definitely want to have like tutorials versus, both. You want, you know, a tutorial and a auto-generated doc, so I can just look up a function real quick, but at the same time, you know, learn a little bit more step by step. So the types of documentation there are, we've got requirements. What does the program do?
Okay.
This is one type of documentation. This might be documentation that you write before you even start a project.
Right. You usually hear this about requirements kind of gathering internal beforehand.
Type documentation, yeah. Then we've got architecture and design. This lays out the general design and reason for specific functionality. So this is going to say stuff like, this function is in here for this reason, but not like go into the details of what it actually does.
Okay. Interesting.
Then there's FAQ, which is just, you know, frequently asked questions.
Right. And that, I mean, that's important because it helps. That helps you on two different ways. I mean, most documentation does. It helps. Oftentimes, good documentation helps you in the long haul because people can look up stuff in the documentation rather than contacting you for support. And an FAQ is a great example of this, where obviously if you're getting a lot of people asking the same question, you might as well document it in some place for your staff and people who aren't your staff to find themselves. Because, I mean, we've talked about this. Sometimes it's hard to get people to read documentation, but those that do read it, if it's out there, then that's less time that you have to spend sort of helping that customer, which, you know, and if you have good user documentation, often they would, I mean, we clearly would rather read documentation than having to contact someone. I find contacting companies for support very tedious and usually annoying when I could have just looked it up in the documentation in the first place.
Yeah. The funny thing, too, about FAQ is it's kind of a stepping stone for them. You know, I've seen customers where some customers just, you know, want to email in and say, you know, I had this problem and blah, 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 and they don't read anything. And then there's the ones that will at least read the FAQ. They might not read the entire documentation, but, right, you know, if it's in the FAQ, they're gonna see it. So it's definitely good to have an FAQ, kind of a short summary, a few questions that, you know, are frequently asked.
Right.
The next one is user-centric documentation. This is going to be user, like, very, you know, do this, screenshots. Right.
Sort of like step-by-step, this is the sort of basic use case using the app, you know, or using whatever. This is sort of like the generic user stuff.
Yeah, this is not going to be kind of like the behind-the-scenes
docs. Which is sort of the next type of documentation, technical, which is usually for people that are going underneath the hood. Usually, let's say if you don't have like an API or anything, usually your technical documentation is for your staff that is writing, you know, your internal staff. It isn't really publicly available because they're, you know, that is sort of two different types of documentation, right? Is there's, you know, or not types, but sort of scope, right? There's internal documentation and external documentation.
Yeah, you know, in technical documentation, it'll have kind of a different style. You'll have like inline code in, you know, in your sentences, mm-hmm. for example. You might use, you know, technical words that you might not use in like user-centric documentation.
Absolutely.
The next one is automatically generated docs. I find these ones to be like the most technical. They're usually, you know, as it says, automatically generated. There's usually some kind of an app that goes through code and, you know, finds what variables can be set, what parameters, and kind of just generates some HTML documentation or PDF or something.
Right. And this, I mean, it is very, it's pure technical documentation. There's really not a whole lot of anything. There's usually not anything user related. It's literally about comments about how the code works or parameters that this function takes. I mean, it's like code documentation.
Yeah. And I mean, there's some pros and cons. One is it can be updated, you know, pretty much every day. Like, you know, as long as, I mean, when the code is updated and pushed out, the documentation is goes along with it. You know,
absolutely.
One of the problems is you don't have a lot of tutorials and things, and users can get frustrated that way. But the next one is, you know, kind of a README. We're all kind of familiar with these. These are, you know, come with the app.
Right. I mean, and I think this is something that can often get overlooked because, you know, you may have your documentation on a website and stuff like that, but a lot of times people get the application and they, you know, you need some sort of documentation inside the application. And that's usually where the README comes in. It's usually in the root of like the application. And it usually has some things in it. But the whole point is that, you know, if somehow this person came along with this, you know, like a tar file with code, Or, you know, someone's like, hey, you know, go fix this application we have, and they don't really know the website for it or anything. There should be something in the root, usually called readme or readme.txt or something, that lets them, that gives them, you know, sort of a square one to start, and that follows your app sort of in the root application.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you see these a lot. GitHub, I think, even requires them, or by
it doesn't
default
require them.
Reads it.
Yeah, but if you have it in there by default, it'll display it when you go to the project, project's code.
So these, I mean, this is a good place to, you know, tell how to install the app if it needs, you know, instructions on how to install it. Copyright info, known bugs. This is a good one, you know, so people kind of know if there are any known bugs that are causing issues before they, you know, fire off an email or something. Most common troubleshooting techniques, a change log. Depending on the project, this is, I don't know. I don't know if it's always necessary to have a change log, but if it's very technical, you might want to put that in there.
Totally.
And then credits. You know, you can put some credits in there.
Yeah.
All right. So let's dive in a little bit more on how to write good documentation. We'll start with user documentation.
Okay.
So
because this
the
is
first,
where, I mean, if could we were, this is what we're kind of talking about. There's user documentation, and then there's like sort of technical documentation. There's like user, right, how to use it, and then there's like, hey, this is how to modify the code or to do, you know, something very technical like the API or something like that. And they do require different things.
Right. So like with user documentation, for example, you might use like a tutorial, something that's quick and can be done within like 30 minutes. You know, the first tutorial should be easy, something, you know, you can always drill down later, get more difficult. You know, this helps the user feel like they're accomplishing something. You know, tutorials are usually step by step. Even though you're kind of holding their hand through it, they'll at least kind of understand that the basics behind it and kind of get going on it, at least get some started so they don't feel like, you know, it's too difficult.
Yeah, you don't want them to feel stupid.
Yeah, and then there's topical guides. You know, these might, you know, cover an entire like area, conceptual area. Like in Ruby on Rails, you've got like models, sessions, controllers, views. You know, so you might have a section on just controllers and how kind of controllers work,
right?
Versus models, and then kind of tie them together, but have different sections say this is the controller, talk about just that, and then go on with sessions, and then maybe later on you have a tutorial that kind of links them together.
Right. So like, I mean, a Facebook tutorial would be like how to use Facebook, but then like topical guides might be like your profile and photos and, you know, like different chunks of the app.
Right. So again, like the key is to have as many forms of documentation as possible. Don't just have a tutorial. I remember seeing that it's the skateboard on the cover of the book, the Ruby on Rails one. It was a tutorial that went from what it was, you like made one app through the whole book.
Yeah.
Which some people like a lot. But some people have a hard time with doing just one, like an app through an entire book. They might feel like it's a waste of time to make something that they're not going to use.
Well, yeah, and that's how I felt. Like, it, you know, a tutorial I thought should be quick and short, and then it should sort of dive into the, like you talked about, like topical guides. I want to know about models, and I want to, you know, not, and then, you know, because like I'm one of those people, I don't like, I'm getting over this, but I don't like writing something that is 100% disposable. So like following, you know, the tutorial of making a blog, I found very frustrating because it was so long. I mean, if it was just, you know, a chapter, that's okay. But then it was like the whole time I'm like, okay, well, I'm reading this entire book, making a huge blog the whole time, and then I'm gonna throw this away. I found that frustrating.
Yeah, you know, there's just so many things that can go wrong with it. You know, one is, let's say you mess up a step in the first chapter and you're like trying to do something on the seventh chapter or something that requires that thing. You know, you can quickly become totally lost. And at the same time, like you said, you know, if you're spending all this time writing something you're never going to use, it's kind of, but you know, then again, that book, I think, got a lot of praise, by other people that really like that style of documentation. Mm-hmm. So I think the main key is to have as many different types.
That's true. Very true.
So it's okay to have a tutorial that makes a blog or something, but you know, keep them short.
Right. And give people that choice.
Vary it up. Have some topical, have some tutorial. So the next one, so that was kind of user documentation. The next one is technical documentation. So the auto generated documentation, I feel, is kind of worthless. And it's slightly better than browsing the source code.
Well, I think it's what you put into it. I mean, I've seen some technical or auto generated technical documentation that is really good because the code is commented really well. So, like, if you use something like JavaDoc or YardDoc for Ruby, they have, like, specific rules of, like, you have to label, you know, sort of each input parameter and each output parameter and say what it does. And that can be useless, too, if it's just, like, you know, if someone says, oh, this is the time. But I've also seen projects where people really have good documentation with that. So, you know, but again, it's the time you put into it. Just because it's documentation for code doesn't mean that it should get skimped out as well. And then that auto-generator one, it describes kind of what you put in there. And if it's good, it's good. And if it's stinky, it stinks.
Yeah, and I definitely think that it goes back to the have different types of documentation. If that's all you have is auto-generated, I think, you know, it borders
that's true.
Kind of worthless or just frustrating, I guess. Right. In my experiences where I could only find technical documentation and nothing else, I became frustrated.
Well, for example, OffLogic, which we use in a lot of our Rails apps, all it has is auto-generated documentation. And then he created a a demo project or something that uses it that you can look at the code for, but there is no sort of hand edited documentation, and it drives me nuts because like there's like a bunch of sort of magical fields where if you like put in that that field name, it just sort of does, you know, a lot of nice stuff for you. But the way to find that was like digging in through the methods in the code, and I found that infuriating. I thought, just give me a page with some of this important stuff to get up and going. And then, yeah, if I want to look through all that stuff, give me the ability, because it doesn't matter because you auto-generate it. You know, it doesn't take you any time to, you know, not include that. But I found it so frustrating that all they had was that technical auto-generated documentation.
Yeah, it's a shame too, because I actually like really like OffLogic. It's a great app.
Very cool.
Or a great plugin.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no substitute for, you know, handwritten and edited documentation, you know, for reference material or APIs, you should still have some nice, like, handwritten summaries and maybe tutorials and different things.
Yeah.
That said, there's some great tools for auto-generated documentation for PHP. We've got PHP Documenter, phpdoc.org. You can find that in our show notes. RDoc and DocTest. For Python, you can actually write the doc. It's actually a unit test that doubles as a doc.
Cool. Oh, that's cool.
Documentation auto-generated.
Yeah, and I will add, I prefer YardDoc to RDoc in Ruby, but we'll link to them both in the show notes. But that about, that wraps it up. And I think the take-home point is that, you know, you should try and write good documentation. And I know it's hard. I know it's tough. No one wants to do it. But it is a really, really good help to your community, and you should probably try and do that. So that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe if you haven't done so yet. Also, leave some feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You know, you can get a hold of us on Twitter, on Facebook, or any other method. We really appreciate it. Thank you guys, and we will see you next week.